This Saturday morning at 9, we're having our second and last work day over at Park Temple Church, one of the new churches we're working with, where we have some missions going now. And a number of you went over there a few weeks ago and nailed up sheetrock and painted and mowed the lawn and did a lot of wonderful things. And they've been having people saved regularly now in that church. And we may not all be able to teach or give much money or do a lot of various things, but everybody can swing a hammer or pull a weed or use a paintbrush. So please try to come over there. Call our missions office. They'll give you more information about the details this Saturday at 9. And by the way, next Wednesday night, we will not have anything here. We will be meeting in the Spring Branch Coliseum, participating with about 35 other churches as a part of the J. Strack Crusade. Spring Branch Coliseum is right next to the Tully Stadium at Derry Ashford out Katy Freeway. They use the same parking lot, and there'll be nothing here. We will have the nursery open, but nothing else. No dinner, no meetings, no choir, nothing. Everybody go straight there. And the evening services will start Sunday through Thursday at 7. All right, let's open our Bibles to Revelation. Tonight, chapter 2 and 3, we're going to do a brief overview and then look at the first of our churches. And let me remind you, please, of the important verse in the first chapter that divides the book for us. Verse number 19, write the things which thou hast seen. That's the vision of Jesus. And the things which are, that's the seven churches of Asia Minor. And the things which shall be hereafter. And that's prophecy. And that starts in chapter 4. So, I want us to begin with chapter number 2. Unto the angel of the church at Ephesus write, these things saith he, who holdeth the seven stars in his right hand, who walketh in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. Now, you will remember that these churches are seven historical churches, but taken in the order as given here, they are also not only pictures of all churches of all time, and we'll see ourselves in one of these churches tonight, but you'll see as well all believers pictured here in each of these churches, and you'll be able to pick yourself out and say, that's me, or that's someone that I know. But one of the things that really lends to the obvious validity of the prophetic nature of the book is that these are also seven pictures in order of the seven ages of church history. So we're going to give an overview of that and then look at the first church. Let's look at these churches as we find them. The first church is the church at Ephesus, and he says, unto this church I know thy works, I know thy labor, I know thy patience. He commends them, but he comes down to verse number 4 and says, nevertheless, I have somewhat against thee, for thou hast left thy first love. This is a church that is the cold church. Now, he commends them on their doctrine, and this is a church that has not tolerated false doctrine. They have their doctrine straight, but they have lost their love for Christ. Now, there are churches all over the world like that. If you pin them down, they will tell you what they believe about Christ and the blood and salvation and the Word. They have sound, straight, strong doctrine. But the big difference in such a church, which is an evangelical church, and an evangelistic church, is that it's not really doing much with what it has. You think in the city, you think back at home of churches that believe the right kinds of things, but there's no evangelistic fervor. There's no hot-spiritedness about them. And to find out how to be saved or what they believe about Christ, you'd have to go to them and ask them and pin them down, and they would tell you, and they would be correct doctrinally, but they have lost their first love. Now, he says to them that they are going to, having lost this first love, that they're going to spend that they are a church that has is on the way, we're going to see, toward becoming an apostate church. Now you say, well, here's a church, they believe the right things, they just don't give invitations, they just don't preach it much. and the spirit is not there, that doesn't seem to be such a bad thing. But this is the first step toward becoming an apostate church. And the seventh of these churches, which is an apostate church, begins with this kind of a spiritual attitude. The second church is the suffering church. So let's say this. The first church at Ephesus that we see is the cold church. It's orthodox, but it's spiritually cold. Secondly, the church at Smyrna is the suffering church. And we'll go back. We're just going to do an overview here for a moment. Under the angel of the church in Smyrna, write these things, saith he that was the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. Verse number 10, fear none of these things which thou shalt suffer. It goes on to say, you shall have tribulation 10 days. Now the word day in the Greek and Hebrew added up together has 16 different meanings. We're not sure how long a day is, but generally it does refer to some sort of a period of time. And so he says that you're going to be a church that suffers for 10 periods of time. Now we know that under the Roman Empire, the church at Smyrna suffered tremendously, particularly from Nero to Diocletian, a period of 100 years this church suffered, from about the year 50 to about the year 150. This was written in the year about 96. So this church was right in the middle of a 100-year period of suffering. So those 10 periods of time of suffering may be 10 decades. Why did the church at Smyrna suffer? Why was it a suffering church? Well, there are four or five reasons. One, because we know historically that they were a militant church. And the religious establishment of the government was afraid of their aggressiveness. They were a church that demanded allegiance to Jesus. In this time, of course, they had to say, Caesar is Lord. They refused to do that. They give allegiance to Jesus. They said, no, Jesus is Lord. They suffered for that. They lived in an idolatrous culture and rejected idolatry. They were accused of being cannibalistic because of the teaching of Jesus, this is my bread and my body, which is hyperbole, simple overstatement for the purposes of emphasis. But people took that the wrong way and said they were practicing cannibalism. And also we know that Smyrna, as we shall see when we study that church, was very, very poor. And so those were the five reasons, because of their aggressiveness in a world of opposition, because of their allegiance to Christ in the world that demanded you say Jesus is Lord, because of their rejection against their world system of idolatry, because they're accused of being cannibalistic, and because they were poor, this church, we know historically, was a suffering church. Do we have any suffering churches today? I think of the church in China. I think of the church in Eastern Europe. I think of the church in Russia. And indeed, we can point out today, and there always have been, churches that suffered. The third church that's here is the church at Pergamos, verse 12. And to the angel of the church at Pergamos write, and these, let me pause right here and say that if the Ephesus church is the cold church and Smyrna was the suffering church, Pergamos is the worldly church. The word Pergamos means mixed marriage. Mixed marriage. Now he says that you live and serve in the church, verse 13, in the area where Satan's seat is. I know your works. I know where you live. I understand where you dwell. And you live where Satan's seat is. Now, there's a key here in the word dwellest. This word dwellest means, in the Greek, taken up permanent residence. In other words, the church has married the world. It has not won the world. It is not, as must be the attitude of the believing church, a church that is just passing through and hangs loose to its culture and is a testimony to the world. No, the church at Pergamos settled down and married the world. And we're going to see, I'm not going to call any names in any of these, and people or preachers or denominations or anything, but you're going to see very obviously what kind of church that was, and from church history, and is today, that is married to the government. The fourth church is the Thyatira church. Verse number 18, unto the angel of the church in Thyatira write. Now verse number 20, he commends them, but he says, I have a few things against thee, because thou sufferest or allowest that woman Jezebel, which calls herself a false prophetess, to teach and seduce my servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols. The problem of this church, and we'll call Thyatira the sinful church, was that the reason it was committing these sins, fornication and sacrificing to idols, specifically pointed eating food sacrificed to idols, specifically pointed out was because they had allowed false teachers in the church. And what one practices will eventually become the result of what one teaches. And what we teach in our church and allow to be church taught will eventually become the practice of the church. And so this was a sinful church because it had not dealt with false teaching and false teachers. And so it was the sinful church. The next church, the church of Sardis, chapter 3, verse 1, was the dead church. And unto the angel of the church at Sardis write, these things saith he that hath the seven spirits of God and the seven stars, I know thy works, that thou hast a name, that thou livest and art dead. In the Greek, the word and here is the word kai, which has the possibility of being interpreted two ways, and, or maybe interpreted but. I think the word but is more natural here. I knowest thy works, thou hast a name that thou livest, but thou art dead. This was a dead church. It is a church that had a name that was alive. It's a church that's living on its past reputation, but has no life, no power today. No one is saved, no lives are changed. It's not the church, as one of these sitcoms on TV calls the church of what's happening now. It's the church of what used to happen then, but nothing was happening now. All right, we come to a very good church, the sixth church in chapter 3, verse 7 and 8, unto the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, he that is holy, etc. We'll come back to that, verse 8. I know thy works, because I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it, for thou hast a little strength, but yet you have strength enough, inferred, and hast kept my word, and hast not denied my name. Here is a church that has been true to the word of God, has honored his name, and is walking through an open door. So the church at Philadelphia is the missionary church. It is the church of the open door. It is the church that is true to Christ and his name and his word and is accepting the opportunity that God has set before it. It is the church of the open door. God has set before it and a vast open door to spread his word, and they are taking advantage of every missionary and evangelistic opportunity right at their doorstep and around the world, and God commends this. He commends this church. Now, the seventh and last church, verse number 14, is the church at Laodicea. It is the apostate church. It is the church that has turned from the truth. Unto the angel of the church at Laodicea write these things, I know thy works, thou art neither cold nor hot. I wish thou wert cold nor hot. Wow, you're making me sick in my stomach. I'm fed up with you. In essence, he says, verse 16, so therefore I will spew thee out of my mouth. We'll really find some interesting things about the church today that has apostatized, has turned from its first love, has turned to cults because it has lost integrity, it's lost sound doctrine, it's lost honor to the name of Christ, it has not walked through its evangelistic open door opportunities, and has become nothing but a country club with a cross on top of it. Now, let me say this to you. There are as well seven kinds of churches not only here, but there are seven kinds of church members, or hopefully Christians. Seven kinds of Christians. Let's look at them. The first kind, and let's see which one you might identify yourself as being in. And let me say this to you too, and this is very important. In every one of these churches where we said, this is the kind of church it is, yet not everybody in that church was like that. You can say this is a missionary evangelistic church, but not everybody in the church is missionary or evangelistic. You can say of a church that you may know somewhere that this church is cold and dead, but there are those people who are alive and love the Lord and are hot-hearted. So when we say a church is so-and-so, that is not to say that everybody is, but it is to say that that is the characteristic of the majority of the people. So in these churches, you find many different kinds of people. Not everybody was like everybody else in any of those churches, any more than everybody is like everybody else in our church, or I suppose any other church. So you find different kinds of people as well in those churches, perhaps every one of these seven kinds, but these were the majority. And so, because you might identify our church as one of these churches, does not mean automatically that each of us individually are one of those kinds of people. So you're going to have to find yourself tonight in this list. So let's apply these now to individuals. The church, first of all, the Ephesus church that had lost its first love. Why had Ephesus lost its first love? They lost their first love strictly because of a matter of time. They were moving away from the immediate physical presence of Jesus Christ. This was two or three generations later. Decades had passed since Christ walked upon the earth, and Ephesus, I'm going to show you in a few moments, was one of the really great hot-hearted churches of history. I'm going to show you in a few minutes that Ephesus may have been the greatest church in the New Testament era. But here, just a couple of generations later, 20, 30, 40 years later, they were now becoming a cold church, an indifferent church, orthodox but dead, because they had simply moved from the proximity of the presence of the living Christ. Now there says something to me that as God lives among his people, that we will tend to grow cold if we move from the physical presence of God and his word and his people. I told you Sunday morning about how we make Jesus Lord afresh each morning. We rekindle those coals and those kindles in the bottom of that stove. In the same way, when all of the coals are together, there is life. But when one of them gets off by itself, it will soon die. They not only give, but they receive light and receive fire and warmth. And so as we remove ourselves from the physical presence of Jesus, we tend to be cold. There are people in our church who absolutely, doctrinally, theologically believe the right things, but who have chosen to remove themselves on a consistent basis from the physical presence of the people of God, and they are orthodox, but they are cold. You really can't count on them. I want to warn you again, as we see in the succession, that the person who may believe the right things, but get away from the fire and the proximity of the presence of Jesus, will eventually, in all likelihood, if they don't turn around and come back and do something about it, apostatize and go all the way from God, because what you believe will be turned in to what you practice. Then there's the church at Smyrna. This represents another kind of Christian. They were bold, and they were suffering for their boldness. There are some of our people who are suffering because of their boldness. They may be the only Christian in their family. A lot of these kids go home, their parents put them down, they tell them about their love for Jesus, they try to live for Christ, and they're made miserable. I received a letter from a woman today who was miserable because her husband was indifferent and cold and not a spiritual leader in the home. And she was hurting in her heart, and she was bold, and she was paying a price for her allegiance to Christ. That happens in the office. There may be a believer that gets passed over. because they won't go to the cocktail parties and they won't participate in things that happen. And so they may be the most qualified person, but because of their boldness for Christ, which makes them the office uncomfortable, someone else gets the promotion. There are kids on this at school who may not get a date. They might not make the sorority. They may be blackballed in the college fraternity because of their witness and their bold stand for Jesus Christ. And this church is commended. You ought to be grateful that you get to suffer for Jesus sometimes because of your boldness. The third kind of believer is the Pergamos believer. Remember, mixed marriage, they married the world. They married the world. They're not soul winners. They show up on Sunday morning. The bars and the clubs are more important to them. Oh, they'll be here on Sunday sometimes, but they're really married to the world. They're a Pergamos believer. Then the fourth kind of believer is the Thyatira believer. A false doctrine has led them wide open into sin. I want you to know that the only hope that you've got to live the right kind of a life is constant exposure to the truth, to the Word of God. And so it is important where we go to church, what we study, what teaching we put ourselves under. It is important that we are hearing sound doctrine. And the Thyatira person is the person who has been led into sin because they have allowed themselves to be exposed to false doctrine. The Sardis believer is dead. They drag in on Sunday. They sing the songs. They don't feel anything. They sit down spiritually. The light's on, but nobody's home. Number six, the Philadelphia believer. That's the soul winner. That's the person that's on fire for Christ. And they're taking advantage of every opportunity the Lord has given them to be a witness for the Lord Jesus. Then there is, of course, the Laodicea believer, who is really a hypocrite. He really is an apostate. That is to say, he does not lose his salvation, but he turns from what he professes to have believed and apostatized. And apostasy is the end of the line. And it begins with a coldness of heart back in point number one. Now, I want to say also to you then for a few moments that these are, in sequence, pictures of the seven ages of church history. I got to tell you, there are a few things that really, I think, excite me about the validity and the validation of the prophetic reality of this book of Revelation, like this simple truth, that these seven churches that were in the shape of a crescent, if you start to order, visit them in order that Paul lists them, you just go around Asia Minor, a little half moon, are also those quality and characteristic of churches, pictures of the church ages of history. Now, when did the church age begin? Well, the church age began at the day of Pentecost. That's when the church was born. The church's birthday was Pentecost. How old is the church today? Well, it's 1989 less 33, and that would be what, 1956? We're 1956 years old, I guess. When does the church age end? It ends with the rapture. When the church is removed, when the believers are caught out, then there's tribulation, and then there's the millennium, which is the reign of Christ on earth, which is the first phase of eternity. And then the new heaven, the new earth. Now, between then, the day of Pentecost, and the day of the rapture of the church, you have the church age. So you and I can see we're living in the very, very end of history. Because where do we stand today? We stand between a door of opportunity that is fast closing all over the world. Since about 1920, we've had the most marvelous late 1800s, the most marvelous opportunity for world evangelism. It was almost impossible to say that you couldn't get into any country of the world in those times. But so many, many, many countries of the world are closed today. And we are living between the sunset of the Philadelphia church age and the sunrise of the age of apostasy. And this is the most dangerous, but the most important opportunistic to work while we have a window of opportunity for the Lord. How much longer is glasnost going to allow Russia to have Christians come in? How much longer will the church be able to take advantage of this new openness in China? Would you have believed 10 years ago that Billy Graham would preach to 95,000, wasn't it, in Poland? But how much longer? And so these ages of the church age, which is one of the seven dispensations of history, has seven periods within the church age. And so the church age began at Pentecost. That's when the church was born, and it ends at the rapture. So let's look sequentially, and this is most interesting to me, that it is sequential, the seven church ages of history. All right? First of all, there is, of course, the Ephesus age. Now, this age lasted from about 50 to about 150. And again, once again, removed from the physical presence of Jesus, winding down, losing their first love, the honeymoon's over, cooling off spiritually, there was from 50 to 150 a diminishing of evangelistic fervor in the world. The church that started off so hot in the year 33 AD peaked between about 50 and 60 and began to slow down and tail off by the year 150. So the first church age of church history is the year 50 to 150. These are always all approximate, of course. Was an age when the church was losing its zeal for Christ and slowing down. The second age of church history happened from about 150 to 312. We know what happened in 312. We'll talk about that for a moment. That's the age of persecution. The church suffered more persecution under Nero and the Caesars than any other period of time in history. That's when believers were being burned at the stake. Now, in the first, understand that what persecution they experienced in 50 to 150 was because of a militant aggressiveness which began to wane. But the persecution of the church from 150 to 312 was caused by more of a contempt of the church rather than a fear and hatred for the church in its aggressiveness. The Pilgrim's Progress, what's the classic work on persecution of Christians? Burned at the stake. And Fox's Book of Martyrs covers primarily, reveals to us that the greatest martyrdom and persecution of the church was from 150 to 312. Now, the year 312 introduces a new era of church history. That's the Pergamos church age, and that lasts to about 600. And that's the age of history when the church married the world. very important event that caused that to happen. You remember that in the year 312 AD, Constantine was riding into battle, leading his forces against Christians, trying to annihilate because of his contempt, not because of fear of an evangelistic fervor, but because of contempt, trying to annihilate Christians from the world. In one of those assaults, he says that he saw a burning cross in the sky. And he heard that a voice, he says, that said, "In this name, conquer." Now, I have to believe that what he saw was a vision and what he heard was a voice given by Satan, not by God. Because what happened does not indicate that God was behind it. Now, God might have wanted to save him personally, but it either wasn't of God, or he didn't do what God wanted him to do if God gave him the vision. Because what Constantine did and introduced an era of in the Pergamos age of church history was anything but Christian. And that is that he set out to make the world Christian by force, to make the world Christian by decree, by government dictatorship. And so what happened was a kind of universal, the word Catholic means universalness from the Roman Empire was begun and went into its strongest era of history. Because what they did was Constantine set out, he was the emperor, by force of the armies and governmental powers that were his to force the world to become Christian. And so what he did was religiously, first of all, was to take everything that was religious in the world and baptize it, and say it's now Christian. And so all of the signs and the emblems and the practices and the abstaining of meats and the taw and the shepherd's rods and all of the symbols and the cups and the collars and everything that began to be the focal point of what Christianity was in those pre-dark ages times was what was pagan at the time. He just took the pagan priests and the pagan symbols and the pagan religions and the pagan temples and the pagan rites and the pagan priests and the pagan doctrines and just baptized them, so to speak, and said, "You're now Christian." And so we have the world married to the government in one of the most awful ages of history. He also believed that baptism was the way people were saved. And of course, it was impossible to baptize everybody. So history tells us it was about this time, so probably by Constantine, that sprinkling was introduced into church history, as he would simply go through towns and in an attempt to baptize everybody and to make everybody a Christian all at once, would not be able to do it individually, and so there might be 5 or 10 or 20 or 50,000 people, and mighty wagons would carry vats of water, and they'd splash them out over everybody and make a sign and say, "You're now all Christian, go on." Now that's pretty dark and pretty eerie, but that is what was going on during that time. There was a national union with the government, and the marriage of church and state was one of the four focal points of the Reformation, which out of which came Protestants that said, "This cannot be anymore." And we still fight the issue of church and state, and Protestants, as you know, will not take government money for their causes. Incidentally, some of you may think that Oklahoma Baptist or Houston Baptist University takes government money. That is not the case. Our Baptist schools do not take government money. Some government money grants go directly to students who get a loan or a grant to attend any university, but the university does not receive it. Well, quite unlike many denominations that are particularly known for their union with church and state, and this, folks, is where it all came from. Now, so back in Smyrna, you see, the suffering church, you were persecuted if you believed in Jesus. In the age of Pergamos, you were persecuted if you didn't believe in Jesus. Isn't that a twist? You were on the outside. You were not a part of the religious establishment. The church that married the world, the darkest, one of the darkest times in church history. Number four, the fourth age of church history is the Thyatira church age, which lasts about 600 to about 1500. Now I say 1500 because about that time the dawning rays of the Reformation were beginning to crack the old staid church from all the way back from 312, and false doctrine had led to sin. And the history of the Roman church from 600 to 1500, which was about all of the Christian religion you'll see in history during those times, was devastating. Because the church married the world affected the church's teaching. And when the church watered down its teaching, when it did not teach right, it did not practice right. And it was the morally darkest era of history, because the church was not doctrinally pure because of its compromise with the world. Hence, it was not morally and ethically pure because its doctrine was not pure. And so we have the Dark Ages. Monks and monasteries, stories that would turn the hair blue, abound about practices of immorality, false fetishes and idols and salvation by works. These things so gripped the world and were in the name Christian that when you have the so-called holy wars trying to force Christianity down the throat of people, this was a, don't ever forget, this was a caricature of Christianity. This was the antithesis. This was an imitation of Christianity. Everything that bears the name Christian is not necessarily Christian at all. Now, somewhere around 1500 to 1750, you have Sardis, the dead church, but you have the dead church starting to come to life. At the beginning of this period of time, you see, these things don't happen overnight. And when we get to 1750, the Philadelphia church age, you're going to see a great era and dawn of world missions and evangelism. But this didn't happen all at once. They didn't get up and say, hoop, hoop, hooray, let's be evangelistic. No, the church moved from its locked-in deadness about 1500 to an era of evangelistic openness in about 1750, very slowly. It was the period of a dead church, but one that was beginning to come to life. And of course, revival and change and life come very slowly in churches, in personal lives, in denomination, and certainly in church history. The Reformation began to occur. These are the days of Luther and Calvin and Huss and Zwingli and the Shermans and the Lollards and John Knox, etc. And these men were again persecuted. Some were burned at the stake. Some they ran for their lives. So the established Roman church that was the government church that had a grip on people did not change overnight. This death to life occurred over about 250 years. Now the good news is that by the time you get to around 1750, the Reformation is in full sway, and people experiencing new life in their lives and in the church are eager to tell and share with others. So you begin to see at about 1750 the dawning of the sixth age of church history, the Philadelphia church age. Trace your history books from 1989 back to the year 33 when Pentecost occurred. Here's what you'll find. The single greatest era of evangelism and missions in history was occurring from 1750 to about the early 20th century, 1920, 1930, along in there. Here are the names of those times: William Carey, Adoniram Judson, Hudson Taylor, the Wesleys, Moody, Spurgeon. Now, the later that you get, the more these names come. Again, don't ever forget, from 1750 to 20, And again, this doesn't stop and start that clearly. You have the age of the Philadelphia church age, the age when a burgeoning church with new life and new vision is massively moving out, and you have the greatest era of evangelistic and missionary outthrust in history. More sermons were written, more gospel songs penned, more schools started, more missionaries sent, more organizations begun, Christian organizations than at any time in history. All right? Now, somewhere around 1920, 1930, church historians say that we began to see the dawning rays of the Laodicean church age. I think there's no question in my mind that that has occurred, because modern-day education has become more liberal. You did not find the debates with Spurgeon and these men with the liberals of their day like we do now. But you belong to a warm-hearted, evangelistic, Bible-believing Southern Baptist church. But remember, we as Southern Baptists, for example, are only less than 10% of the people in this country. Maybe 5%, I would guess. 14,280,000. And I heard Billy Graham make the statement that only that 60%, conservatively 60%, of the pulpits in the North American continent, Canada, United States, do not believe the basic tenets of the faith, the basic things. Virgin birth, incarnation, blood atonement, bodily resurrection. We can't see the forest for the trees. We think everybody's like us. Everybody's not like us. Generally, Southern Baptists, Nazarenes, Charismatics, Assemblies of God, historically, certain Methodists, certain Presbyterians, certainly the Independents, the Bible Church folks, are generally historically conservative. But you've just named a very, very few of the hundreds and hundreds of the 1900 denominations and cults and sects listed with our government. Now keep in mind, there are preachers and there are believers in Methodist and Presbyterian and Lutheran and Catholic and Episcopalian churches that love Jesus and are saved and preach the purity of the gospel. By the same token, there are some foxes in the Southern Baptist hen house. By the same token, we've got some folks in our schools and in our very churches that don't believe the right kinds of things. So we can't broad stroke everybody or everything. But generally speaking, Bible-believing conservatives that believe the things you do are in the strong minority in the country and in the world. So don't think for a moment that we are not in the apostate Laodicean church age just because you are not in an apostate Laodicean church. So we are somewhere between the dawning, the closing days of the sixth Philadelphia church age and the seventh and final apostate church age. In fact, we're going to see when we get deeper into Revelation that the Antichrist himself will not only be a political leader, but he will also be a religious leader for the world. And so politics and religion will again merge. And just as the Roman Empire gave birth to this, so according to Daniel's prophecy, these 10 toes we're going to see are going to, I think, bring about a recreated Roman Empire. And we're seeing, remember when I did this 10 years ago? I said, don't think that the revised Roman Empire that will give birth to this Antichrist will be a world's religious and political leader is necessary to the European common market now. It is now in a state of flux. There may be 11 one day, 13 the next day, 9 the next. But when you see it settling in the future, and that time is now, to real 10 solid countries committed to a commonality and wanting to be the ultimate financial power in the world, watch it. Now you're seeing a revised Roman Empire from which I believe will come, and we'll get into this later, an Antichrist that will be both a, remember, religious and political leader. So you're going to see a resurgence, a rebirth of the Pergamos church, the church where the church marries the world. Now, in the next 10 closing minutes, I want us to look just for a moment at this particular first church, and that's a little bit of overview of the historical churches, all the churches and individuals. Let's look at just 6 or 7 verses here. Unto the angel of the church at Ephesus. Now, this is the Orthodox church, but the one, remember, that has lost its first love. Who is the angel of the church? Well, we have seen that the angel of the church, in verse number 20, is the pastor of the church. Aren't you glad to know your angel, your pastor, just a little angel? Well, get that man's name and phone number. Okay, well, that's what a good book say. Okay, now, we have seen 2,000 years later that what has happened in the apostate church age starts here with a cooling off. Incidentally, isn't it something that 5 of these 7 churches are rebuked? Why is that? Well, because he allows the wheat to grow with the tares. Even though 5 of these 7 kinds of churches and believers are not good, what do we find? These things saith he that holdeth the 7 stars in his right hand. Who are those stars? Those are the churches. We've seen that. And so we see that Jesus, even though all these 7 churches are not good churches, even though 5 of them are rebuked, still he stands in the middle of them. He still holds up his churches. Why is that? Why does he not drop those other 5? Why didn't he bring down the wrath of God on them? Because he allows the wheat to grow with the tares, because there is wheat among those tares. In the worst church of this city that you can think of, doctrinally and morally, there are some good born-again folks. I believe that. Just as in the best church in this city, there are some unsaved and immoral folks. And so he lets them grow together. So it is significant that he is still in the midst of these churches. He doesn't abandon them. He stays right there. And he says in verse number 2. Let me say this. This is interesting. In every one of these 7 letters, he identifies himself, the sender, the author, the writer, Jesus. He identifies himself with one of the characteristics of the vision in chapter 1. Did you get that? The vision of chapter 1 in Jesus as prophet, priest, and king, as ancient of days, as he who was and is to come. He gives some characteristics of himself. In every one of these 7 vision letters to these churches, he identifies himself, describes himself as the author, the writer, the sender, by one of these characteristics. And the first one is, unto these things saith he, who? The one who holds the 7 stars in his right hand. That's Jesus. And who walks in the midst of the 7 golden candlesticks, the pastors and the churches. Now, let me pause right here and tell you that it is an unbelievable thing how fast Ephesus became a cold church. In the year 56 AD, the Ephesus church was born. It was established by the Apostle Paul on his 3rd missionary journey. Paul stayed as little as 3 weeks in some of the churches he established. But the Apostle Paul himself established the church at Ephesus and stayed there at least 2 years and 3 months, and might have had 3 years. Now listen to this. He established the church and grounded it. Timothy became its first permanent pastor. The great evangelist of the New Testament, Apollos, held revivals there. And the great teaching saints, Aquila and Priscilla, were in charge of the education program. But 40 years later, it was a cold, dead church, hanging on to its orthodoxy, but losing its love for Jesus Christ. Now, folks, you got to get hold of this. You cannot love the pastor and love the preaching and love the music and love the pageant and love choir rehearsal and love souls and love missions preeminently. You must love Jesus preeminently. Because these things are subject to change. They will disappoint. They will fail you. They will be in a state of flux. They will come and they will go. That's why Jesus said, do not rejoice because you got power over demons and can raise the dead. You rejoice in me because your name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Here is a church that had a marvelous beginning. Let me show you just how marvelous it was. Turn to Acts chapter 19 for just a quick moment. Acts chapter 19, verse number 17. Here's the beginning of the church and how powerful the First Baptist Church of Ephesus was. The First Methodist or First whatever it was. Acts, what a warning and challenge this is to us. Acts 19, verse 17. Here's a miracle by Paul in Ephesus. And get verse 17. And this was known to all the Jews and all the Greeks dwelling at Ephesus. Hey, there ain't nobody in the world but Jews and Greeks. That's just another way of saying that everybody in Ephesus knew about the miraculous working power of God. And how many people lived in Ephesus? Historians tell us about 3 million. Here was a church making such an impact on the community that a city of 3 million were aware of and impressed with and impacted by what was happening. It was the crossroads of the world. It was the trade crossroads of the trade routes. It was where the Temple Diana was. And all in amidst of all of this religion and all of these cults and all of this commerce and all of this greatness and education, God planted a great church. But in 40 years, they were dead. Oh, they had the right things tattooed on the walls, but their spirits were dead. What a challenge to a church that believes the right things not to lose its love for Jesus Christ. That was their problem. Now, in every one of these letters, back to Revelation, he will commend them. You husbands, remember the bride is the churches and Jesus is the groom. And before you say anything strong or unkind or suggestive to your wife about how much you might do a little bit better, you better put the anesthetic on first and commend her. In every case, he commends the churches before he rebukes and condemns and corrects the churches. Now look what he says in verse 2. I know thy works. This is the Greek word kapos, which means sweating toil. This was an evangelistic church. I believe they were building missions, they were sweating, they were working, they were winning souls, they were out after it. But the people had become spectators rather than participators. He says, I know thy patience. Now this word patience, this Greek word, does not mean a passing of time, just sitting around. It means aggressive effort in the face of tough opposition. They had a holy hanging in there-ness about them. He says, I know that you cannot bear them which are evil, but you've tried them which say they are apostles and found them liars. They put false teachers on the stand and tried them and dismissed them. That's what they did in their early days. Now, historians tell us that there were four kinds of false teachers in the church at Ephesus. The legalists, who said it's one thing to be saved, but you got to do the works of the law to keep saved. The libertarians, who said because of the grace of God, you can sin if you want to. There were those who gathered doctrine elsewhere and brought it into their church. Other doctrine strange to theirs. And there were those who were the takers, who took of the physical benefits of the church, but never gave. Are you one of those? Do you come and enjoy the air conditioning, the parking, the policemen, the paving, and the lights, and the sound, and the choir, and the robes, and everything? But you're not paying your fair share? That was one of the four things that he said they dealt with and tried and rid of themselves of. He says this was a church that was very, very strong. Now, and he said also, look down in verse 6, this thou hast, I say this in your favor, that thou hatest the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. Who were the Nicolaitans? They were the followers of a cult, a libertine kind of cult, I didn't say libertarian, libertine I did, but I didn't mean that, a kind of cult that allowed licentiousness, taught, led by a deacon named Nicholas. He was teaching that because of God's grace, you can just sin all you want to. Clement, the church's father, one of our church fathers, said of the Nicolaitans that they abandoned themselves to pleasure and had the morality of goats. The third verse, and thou hast borne and hast patience for my name's sake. Why did they do this? Why did they try those who were wrong? Why did they stand for the right? They did it for sake for the Lord Jesus Christ at the first, but then they lost it. And from 56 to 96, things went down. Can a church lose it? Is that a serious possibility? Spurgeon, at the peak of his ministry, preached to 5,000 people every Sunday morning. He was the greatest Bible preacher since the days of the Apostle Paul. Now today, barely 100 years after his death, in that 5,000-seat Spurgeon Tabernacle, you will not find 350 people on Easter. You'll find 100 the rest of the time. Why? Because they left their first love. Our first love is not doctrine or Bible study or mission. It's not even souls. Our first love has to be Jesus Christ. Now, a city also died. How many of you have ever been overseas and visited Ephesus? Of course you haven't. Well, there is no Ephesus. There are ruins of Ephesus. There are stones where Ephesus was, but there is no more Ephesus at all. Where is England today? Do you know that England, the mighty military power of England, they used to say the sun never set on the British Empire, the greatest world military power of our time before the United States and Russia for centuries and centuries and centuries, way back since the earliest times of history? Where's England today? Why, when they wanted to fight down over the little Falkland Islands and send 7,000 troops down, they had to commandeer the Queen Mary to go do it. That is how weak the English are today. What caused England to fall? England was the sending agency from 1750 to 1920 for world missions. England was the hotbed of evangelism and mission based that went out over the world. But today, rationalism and higher criticism and liberal theology have so come out of England and the continent that, spiritually speaking, they are dead. I believe that England died because England lost its spiritual heart and England's churches died, just as I believe Ephesus died because the church at Ephesus lost its heart. And if America dies, it will be because America loses its spiritual heart. One last word, verse number 7, chapter 2, verse 7. He that hath an ear, and he says, anybody that's really listening up, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. Now, the churches are the people of God. He does not say, you and the churches, you people of God, listen to this. He says, you who are in the presence of the churches, you who are kind of hanging around the people of God, you better listen up to what God is saying to the churches, not what he is saying to you. You listen to what he's saying to them. And so those to whom are listening to what he'd been saying to the churches, he now says something to them. So these are not the churches. These are the people in the churches, the visitors of the churches, the attendees of the church who are not part of the church. Here's what he says to the visitor. Here's what he says perhaps to the lost. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. Turn back to 1 John 5:5 when you get home, and you'll say that he that overcometh is John's description of a believer. So he's giving an appeal, an invitation to the lost who are attending the churches and hearing this message and saying, if you will become an overcomer, you can have right to the tree of life. You can be saved. Isn't that just like Jesus to finish this message and this letter by giving an invitation to the lost who just happen to be there and be listening? Father, we thank you so much for the Word of God. Thank you for what you've said.
The following sermon by Dr. John Bisogno has been recorded and produced by the Resource Center of